Green Mars, Cassette 14.
Part 9. The Spur of the Moment. Inhabiting new country is always a challenge. As soon as the tenting of Nergal Vallis was done, Séparation de l'Atmosphère set up some of their largest mesocosm aerators, and soon the tent was filled with 500 millibars of a nitrogen-oxygen-argon mix that had been pulled and filtered out of the ambient air, now at 240 millibars. And the settlers started moving in from Cairo and Senzeni-Na and everywhere else on the two worlds. First, people lived in mobile trailers next to small portable greenhouses, and while they worked on the soils of the canyon with bacteria and plows, they used the greenhouses to grow their starter crops, and the trees and bamboo they would use to build their houses, and the desert plants they would spread outside the farms. The smectite clays on the canyon floor were a very good base for a soil, though they had to add biota, nitrogen, potassium. There was plenty of phosphorus and more salts than they wanted, as usual. So they spent their days augmenting the soil and growing greenhouse crops and planting hardy salt desert plants. They traded all up and down the valley, and little market hamlets sprang up almost the day people moved in, as well as trails between homesteads and a trunk road running down the middle of the valley next to the stream. Nergal Vallis had no aquifer at its head, and so a pipeline from Marineris pumped enough water to the head to start a small stream running. Its waters were collected at the Ouzboy Gate and piped back up to the top of the tent again. The homesteads were about half a hectare each, and almost everyone was trying to grow the bulk of their food on that space. Most divided their land up into six miniature fields, rotating crops and pasturage each season. Everyone had their own theories of cropping and soil augmentation. Most people grew a small cash crop, nuts or fruits or lumber trees. Many kept chickens, some kept sheep, goats, pigs, cows. The cows were almost all miniatures, no bigger than pigs. They tried to keep the farms down on the canyon floor by the stream, leaving the higher, rougher ground under the canyon walls to wild land. They introduced an American Southwest community of desert animals so that lizards and turtles and jackrabbits began to live nearby, and coyotes, bobcats, and hawks to make depredations among their chickens and sheep. They had an infestation of alligator lizards, then one of toads. Populations slowly settled into their sizes, but there were frequent, sharp fluctuations. The plants began to spread on their own. The land began to look as if its life belonged there. The red rock walls stood unchanged, sheer and craggy over the new riverine world. Saturday morning was market day, and people drove down to the market hamlets in full pickups. One morning in the early winter of 42, they gathered in Playa Blanco under dark, cloudy skies to sell late vegetables and dairy products and eggs.
You know how you can tell which eggs have live chicks in them? You take them all and put them in a tub of water and wait until it's all gone completely still. Then the eggs that tremble just a little bit are the ones with live chicks in them. You can put those back under the hens and eat the rest.
A cubic meter of hydrogen peroxide is like 1,200 kilowatt hours, and besides, it weighs a ton and a half. No way you'll need that much.
We're trying to get it into the parts per billion range, but no luck yet. Centro de Educación y Tecnología in Chile, they've really done some great work on rotation. You won't believe it. Come over and see.
Storm coming.
We keep bees, too. Maja is Nepali, Bahram is Farsi, Marth is Welsh. Yeah, it does sound like a lisp, but I'm probably not pronouncing it right. Welsh spelling is bizarre. They probably pronounce it Moth or Mort or Mars.
Then word spread through the marketplace, leaping from group to group like a fire.
Nergal is here! Nergal is here! He's going to talk at the pavilion!
And there he was, walking fast at the head of a growing crowd, greeting old friends and shaking hands with people who approached him. Everyone in the hamlet followed him, jamming into the pavilion and volleyball court at the western end of the market. Wild howls rang out over the crowd buzz. Nergal stood on a bench and began to speak. He talked about their valley and the other new tented land on Mars and what it meant. But as he was getting to the larger situation of the two worlds, the storm overhead broke big time. Lightning began to stab all the lightning rods, and in quick succession they saw rain, snow, sleet, and then mud. The tenting over the valley was pitched as steep as a church roof, and dust and fines were repelled by the static charge of its piezoelectric outer layer. Rain ran right off it, and snow slid down and piled up against the bottom of the sides, forming drifts that were blown away by huge robotic snowplows with long angled blower extensions, which rolled up and down the foundation road during snowstorms. Mud, however, was a problem. Mixed with the snow, it formed cold, concrete, hard packs on the tenting just above the foundation, and this dense pack could get heavy enough to cause tent failure. It had happened once before in the north. So when this storm turned ugly and the light in the canyon was like the color of a branch, Nergal said, "We'd better get up there." And they all piled into the trucks and drove to the nearest elevator that ran up inside the canyon wall to the rim. Up on top, the people who knew how took over the snowplows and drove them by hand, with the great blowers now spraying steam over the drifts to wash them off the tenting. Everyone else teamed up and took hand-pulled steam carts out and worked on moving the piles of sludge brought down by the snowplows away from the foundation. This was what Nergal helped with, running around with a steam hose like he was playing some strenuous new sport. No one could keep up his pace, but quickly they were all thigh-deep in cold, swirling mud, with winds over 150 and solid, low black clouds spitting more mud down on them all the time. The winds surged to 180 kilometers an hour, but no one minded. It helped clear the tent of the mud. They made sweep after sweep, moving east with the wind, pushing rivers of mud over the drop into uncovered Oozeboy Vallis. When the storm ended, the tenting was fairly clear, but the land on both sides of Nergal Vallis was deep in frozen mud, and the crews were soaked. They piled back into elevators and dropped to the canyon floor, exhausted and cold, and when they got out at the bottom, they looked at each other, entirely black figures, except for their faceplates. Nergal pulled off his helmet, and there he was, laughing hard, irrepressible. And when he scooped mud off his helmet and threw it at them, the fight was on. Most found it prudent to keep their helmets on, and it was a strange sight there on the dark floor of that canyon, blind, muddy figures throwing clumps of mud at each other and running out into the stream, slipping around as they wrestled and dove. Maya Katerina Toitovna woke in a foul mood, disturbed by a dream that she deliberately forgot as she rolled out of bed. Like flushing the toilet after that first trip to the bathroom, dreams were dangerous. She dressed with her back to the little mirror over the sink, then went downstairs to the dining common. All of Sabishi had been built in its signature Martian Japanese style, and her neighborhood had the look of a Zen garden, all pine and moss scattered among polished pink boulders. It was beautiful in a spare way that Maya found unpleasant, a kind of rebuke to her wrinkles. She ignored it as best she could and concentrated on breakfast, the dead boredom of the daily necessities. At another table, Vlad and Ursula and Marina were eating with a group of the Sabishi Issei. The Sabishians had all shaved their heads and in their work jumpers looked like Zen monks. One of them turned on a tiny screen over their table and a Terran news show began, a metanational production from Moscow that had the same relationship to reality that Pravda had once had. Some things never changed. This was the English-language version, the speaker's English better than her own, even after all these years. Now the latest on this fifth day of August, 2114. Maya stiffened in her chair. In Sabishi, it was LS-246, very near perihelion. The fourth day of 2nd November. The day's short, the night's warmish for this M-year 44. Maya had had no idea what the Terran date was, and hadn't for years. But back there, it was her birthday. Her. She had to calculate. Her. 130th birthday. Feeling sick, she scowled and threw her half-eaten bagel on her plate, stared at it. Thoughts burst in her head like birds scattering out of a tree. She couldn't track them. It was like being blank. What did it mean, this horrible, unnatural age? Why had they turned on the screen at just that moment? She left the half-moon of bread, which had taken on an ominous look, and walked outside into the autumn morning light. Down the lovely main boulevard of Sabishi's old quarter, green with street grass, red with broad-topped fire maples, there was one maple blocking the low sun and flaring scarlet. Across the plaza outside their dorm, she saw Yeli Zudov playing skittle bowl with a young child, perhaps Mary Dunkel's great-great-granddaughter. There were a lot of the first 100 in Sabishi now. It was working well as their demi-monde, all of them tucked into the local economy and the old quarter, with false identities and Swiss passports, everything amazingly solid, enabling them to live surface lives. And all without the need for the kind of cosmetic surgery that had so altered Saks, because age had done that surgery for them. They were unrecognizable just as they were. She could walk the streets of Sabishi, and people would see only one ancient crone among many others. If transitional authority officials stopped her, they would identify one Ludmila Novosibirskaya. But the truth was, they wouldn't stop her. She walked through the city trying to get away from herself. From the north end of the tent, she could see outside the town to the great mound of rock that had been brought up out of Sabishi Mohol. It formed a long, sinuous hill running uphill to the horizon across the high Krumholtz basins of Tarina. They had designed the mound so that from above it formed the image of a dragon clutching the egg-like tents of the town in its talons. A shadowed cleft crossing the mound marked where a talon left the scaled flesh of the creature. The morning sun shone like the dragon's silver eye, staring back over its shoulder at them. Her wrist pad beeped, and irritably she took the call. It was Marina. "Saxifrage is here," she said. "We're going to meet out in the Western Stone Garden in an hour." "I'll be there," Maya said, and cut the connection. What a day it was turning out to be. She wandered west along the city perimeter, abstracted and depressed. 130 years old. There were Abkhazians down in Georgia on the Black Sea who were reputed to have lived to such ages without the treatment. Presumably, they were still doing without. The gerontological treatments had been only partially distributed on Earth following the isobars of money and power, and the Abkhazians had always been poor. Happy, but poor. She tried to remember what it had been like in Georgia, in the region where the Caucasus met the Black Sea. Sukhumi, the town was called. She felt she had visited it in her youth. Her father had been Georgian. But she could call no image to mind, not a scrap. In fact, she could scarcely remember anything of any part of Earth. Moscow, Baikonur, the view from Novi Mir, none of it. Her mother's face across the kitchen table, laughing blackly as she ironed or cooked. Maya knew that had happened because she rehearsed the words of the memory from time to time when she was feeling sad. But the actual images... Her mother had died only 10 years before the treatment became available, or she might be alive yet. She would be 150, not at all unreasonable. The current age record was around 170, and rising all the time, with no sign that it would ever stop. Nothing but accidents and rare diseases and the occasional medical mistake were killing the treated these days. Those, and murder, and suicide. She came to the Western Rock Gardens without having seen any of the neat narrow streets of Sabishi's old quarter. That was how the old ended up not remembering recent events, by not seeing them in the first place. Memory lost before it ever came to be, because one was focusing so intently on the past. Vlad and Ursula and Marina and Sax were seated on a park bench across from Sabishi's original habitats, which were still in use, at least by geese and ducks. The pond and bridge, and banks of riprap and bamboo, were straight out of an old woodblock or silk painting. A cliché. Beyond the tent wall, the great thermal cloud of the Mohol billowed whitely, thicker than ever as the hole got deeper and the atmosphere more humid. She sat down on the bench across from her old companions, stared at them grimly. Mottled, wrinkled codgers and crones. They looked almost like strangers, people she had never met. Ah, but there were Marina's sultry hooded eyes and Vlad's little smile. Not surprising on the face of a man who had lived with two women, apparently in harmony and certainly in a completely isolated intimacy for 80 years. Although it was said that Marina and Ursula were a lesbian couple, and Vlad only a sort of companion or pet. But no one could say for sure. Ursula, too, looked content, as always. Everybody's favorite aunt. Yes, with concentration, one could see them. Only Sax looked utterly different, a dapper man with a broken nose that he still hadn't had straightened. It stood in the middle of his newly handsome face like an accusation against her, as if she had done it to him and not Phyllis. He didn't meet her eye, but only stared mildly at the ducks clacking around his feet, as if studying them. The scientist at work. Except he was a mad scientist now, wreaking havoc with all their plans, completely beyond rational discourse. Maya pursed her lips and looked at Vlad. Subarashi and Amex are increasing the number of transitional authority troops, he said. We got a message from Hiroko. They've bulked up the unit that attacked Zygote into a kind of expeditionary force, and it's now moving south between Argyre and Hellas. They don't seem to know where most of the hidden sanctuaries are, but they're checking hotspots one by one, and they entered Christianopolis and took it over as a base of operations. There's about 500 of them, heavily armed and protected from orbit. Hiroko says she's only just barely keeping Coyote and Kasei and Dao from leading the Mars First guerrillas in an attack on them. If they find many more sanctuaries, the radicals are bound to call for an attack. Meaning the wild youngsters of Zygote, Maya thought bitterly. They had brought them up poorly, the ectogenes and that whole Sansei generation. Almost 40 now and itching for a fight. And Peter and Kasei and the rest of the Nisei generation were nearing 70, and in the ordinary course of things should have long since become the leaders of their world, and yet here they were, always in the shadow of their undying parents, and how did that make them feel? How might they act on those feelings? Perhaps some of them were figuring that another revolution would be just the thing to give them their chance, perhaps the only thing. Revolution was the empire of the young, after all. The old ones sat around watching the ducks in silence. A somber, dispirited group. What happened to the Christians? Maya asked. Some went to Hiranyagarbha. The rest stayed. If the transitional authority forces took over the southern highlands, then the underground might have infiltrated the cities, but to what purpose? Scattered so thinly, they couldn't budge the two-world order, based as it was on Earth. Suddenly, Maya had the ugly feeling that the whole independence project was no more than a dream, a compensatory fantasy for the decrepit survivors of a losing cause. "You know why this step up in security has happened," she said, glaring at Sax. "Those big sabotages were what did it." Sax showed no sign of hearing her. Vlad said, "It's too bad we couldn't have fixed on some sort of plan of action at Dorsa Brevia." "Dorsa Brevia," Maya said scornfully. "It was a good idea," Marina said. "Maybe it was. But without a plan of action, agreed on by all, the constitutional stuff was just..." Maya waved a hand. "Building sandcastles. A game." "The notion was that each group would do what it thought best," Vlad said. "That was the notion in 61, Maya pointed out. "And now, if Coyote and the Radicals start a guerrilla war and it touches things off, then we're right back in 61 all over again." "What do you think we should do?" Ursula asked her curiously. "We should take over ourselves. We make the plan. We decide what to do. We disseminate it through the underground. If we don't take responsibility for this, then whatever happens will be our fault." "That's what Arkady tried to do," Vlad pointed out. "At least Arkady tried. We should build on what was good in his work." She laughed shortly. "I never thought I would hear myself say that. But we should work with the Bogdanovists and then everyone else who will join. We have to take charge. We are the first 100. We are the only ones with the authority to pull it off. The Sabishians will help us, and the Bogdanovists will come along." "We need Praxis, too," Vlad said. "Praxis and the Swiss. It has to be a coup rather than a general war." "Praxis wants to help," Marina said. "But what about the Radicals?" "We have to coerce them," Maya said. "Cut off their supplies, take away their members." "That way leads to civil war," Ursula objected. "Well, they must be stopped. If they start a revolt too soon and the Metanationals come down on us before we're ready, then we're doomed. All these uncoordinated strikes at them ought to stop. They accomplish nothing. They only increase the levels of security and make things more difficult for us. Things like knocking Deimos out of its orbit only make them more aware of our presence without doing anything else." Sax, still observing the ducks, spoke in his odd, lilting way. "There are 114 Earth-to-Mars transit ships. 47 objects in Mars orbit. The new Clark is a fully defended space station. Deimos was available to become the same. A military base. A weapons platform." "It was an empty moon," Maya said. "As for the vehicles in orbit, we will have to deal with those at the appropriate time." Again, Sax didn't appear to notice she had spoken. He stared at the damned ducks, blinking mildly, glancing from time to time at Marina. Marina said, "It has to be a matter of decapitation, like Nadia and Nergal and Art said in Dorsa Brevia." "We'll see if we can find the neck," Vlad said dryly. Maya, getting angrier and angrier at Sax, said, "We should each take one of the major cities and organize people there into a unified resistance. I want to return to Hellas." "Nadia and Art are in South Fossa," Marina said, "but we'll need all the first 100 to join us for this to work." "The first 39, Sax said. "We need Hiroko," Vlad said, "and we need Hiroko to talk some sense into Coyote." "No one can do that," Marina said, "but we do need Hiroko. I'll go to Dorsa Brevia and talk to her, and we'll try to hold the South in check." "Sax?" Vlad said. Sax jerked out of his reverie, blinked at Vlad. Still not a glance for Maya, even though they were discussing her plan. "Integrated pest management," he said. You grow tougher plants among the weeds, and then the tougher plants push them out. I'll take Burrows. Furious at Sax's snubbing of her, Maya got up and walked around the little pond. She stopped at the opposite bank, gripped the railing by the path in both hands. She glared at the group across the water, sitting on their benches like retired pensioners, chatting about food and the weather and ducks and the last chess match. Damn Sax, damn him! Would he hold Phyllis against her forever, that vile woman? Suddenly she heard their voices, tiny but clear. There was a curving ceramic wall behind the path, running almost all the way around the pond, and she was almost precisely across the pond from them. Apparently the wall functioned as a sort of whispering gallery. She could hear them in perfect miniature, the airy voices a fraction of a second behind their mouths' little movements. "Too bad Arkady didn't survive," Vlad said. "The Bogdanovists would come around a lot easier." "Yes," said Ursula. "Him and John, and Frank." "Frank," Marina said scornfully. "If he hadn't killed John, none of this would have happened." Maya blinked. The railing was holding her up. "What?" she shouted without thinking. Across the pond, the little figures jerked and looked at her. She detached herself from the railing one hand at a time and half ran around the pond, stumbling twice. "What do you mean?" she shouted at Marina as she neared them, the words bursting from her without volition. Vlad and Ursula met her a few steps from the benches. Marina remained seated, looking away sullenly. Vlad had his hands out, and Maya tore right through them to get at Marina. "What do you mean saying such foul things?" she shouted, her voice painful in her own throat. "Why? Why? It was Arabs who killed John. Everyone knows that." Marina grimaced and shook her head, looking down. "Well?" Maya cried. "It was a manner of speaking," Vlad said from behind. "Frank did a lot to undermine John in those years. You know that's true. Some say he inflamed the Muslim Brotherhood against John, that's all." "Ha!" Maya said. "We've all argued with each other. It means nothing." Then she noticed that Sax was looking right at her, finally, now that she was furious, staring at her with a peculiar expression, cold and impossible to read, a glare of accusation, of revenge. Of what? She had shouted in Russian, and the others had replied in kind, and she didn't think Sax spoke it. Perhaps he was just curious about what had upset them so, but the antipathy in that steady stare, as if he were confirming what Marina had said, hammering it into her like a nail. Maya turned and fled. She found herself in front of the door to her room with no memory of crossing Sabishi, and threw herself inside as if into her mother's arms. But in the beautiful spare wooden chamber, she drew up short of the bed, shocked by the memory of some other room that had turned from womb to trap on her, in some other moment of shock and fear. No answers, no distraction, no escape. Over the little sink, she caught sight of her face as if in a framed portrait, haggard, ancient, eyes bright red around the rims like the eyes of a lizard, a nauseating image. That was it. The time she had caught sight of the stowaway on the Ares, the face seen through an algae jar. Coyote. A shock which had proved not hallucination, but reality. And so it might be with this news of Frank and John. She tried to remember. She tried with all her might to remember Frank Chalmers, to really remember him. She had spoken with him that night in Nicosia, in an encounter unremarkable for its awkwardness and tension, Frank, as always, acting aggrieved and rejected. They had been together at the very moment John was being knocked unconscious and dragged into the farm and left to die. Frank couldn't have. But of course there were surrogates. You could always pay people to act for you. Not that the Arabs would have been interested in money, per se, but pride, honor, paid in honor, or in some political quid pro quo, the kind of currency Frank had been so expert at printing. But she could remember so little of those years, so little of the specifics. When she put her mind to it and forced herself to remember, to recollect, it was frightening how little came up. Fragments, moments, potsherds of an entire civilization. Once she had been so angry she had knocked a coffee cup off a table, the broken handle bare like a half-eaten bagel on a table. But where had that been, and when, and with whom? She couldn't be sure. Ah! She cried involuntarily, and the haggard antediluvian face in the mirror suddenly disgusted her with its pathetic reptile pain. So ugly! And once upon a time, she had been a beauty. She had been proud of that. She had used it like a scalpel. Now, her hair had gone from pure white to a dull gray in recent years, changed somehow in the last treatment. And now it was thinning, for God's sake, and only in some places, while not in others. Disgusting. And once a beauty, once upon a time. That hawkish, regal face, and now, as if the Baroness Blixen, also a rare beauty in her youth, had crumbled into the syphilitic witch Isak Dinesen, and then lived on for centuries after that, like a vampire or a zombie, a ravaged living lizard of a corpse, 130 years old. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. She strode to the sink and yanked on the side of the mirror, revealing a crowded medicine cabinet. Nail scissors on the top shelf. Somewhere on Mars they made nail scissors of magnesium, no doubt. She took them down and pulled a hank of hair out from her head till it hurt and cut it off right against her scalp. The blades were dull, but if she pulled hard enough, they worked. She had to be careful not to cut her scalp. Some tiny remnant of her vanity would not allow that. So it was a long, tedious, painstaking and pain-giving job. But a comfort somehow to be so distracted, so methodical, so destructive. The initial cut was ragged enough to require a great deal of trimming, which took a long time, an hour. But she couldn't make the hairs come to the same length, and finally she got out the razor from the shower and finished by shaving, patting with toilet paper the cuts that bled copiously, ignoring the old scars revealed, the awful bumps and hollows of the bare skull, so close under the skin. It was hard to do it all without ever looking at the monstrous face hanging from the front of the skull. When she was done, she stared ruthlessly at the freak in the mirror. Androgynous, withered, insane. The eagle becomes vulture. Skinhead, wattled neck, beady eyes, hook nose, and the lipless, downturned little mouth. Staring at this hideous face, there were long, long moments when she couldn't remember a single thing about Maya Toitovna. She stood frozen in the present. A stranger to everything. A knock at the door made her jump and released her. She hesitated, suddenly ashamed, even frightened. Another part of her croaked, "Come in." The door opened. It was Michel. He saw her and stopped in the doorway. "Well," she said, staring at him and feeling naked. He swallowed, cocked his head. "Beautiful as ever," with a crooked grin. She had to laugh. She sat on her bed and began to weep. She sniffed and sniffed. "Sometimes," she said, wiping her eyes, "sometimes I wish I could stop being Toitovna. I get so tired of it, of everything that I've done." Michel sat beside her. We're locked in ourselves to the end. This is the price one pays for thought. But which would you rather be? Convict or idiot? Maya shook her head. I was down in the park with Vlad and Ursula and Marina and Sax, who hates me, and looking at them all, and we have to do something, we really do. But looking at them and remembering everything, trying to remember, we suddenly all seemed such damaged people. A lot has happened, Michelle said, and put his hand on hers. Do you have trouble remembering? Maya shivered and clasped his hand like a life raft. Sometimes I get so scared that I'll forget everything. She sniffed a laugh. I guess that means I'd rather be a convict than an idiot, to answer your question. If you forget, you're free of the past, but nothing means anything. So there's no escape. She started to cry again. Remember or forget, it hurts just as bad. Memory problems are pretty common at our age, Michelle said gently. Especially events in the middle distance, so to speak. There are exercises that help. It's not a muscle. I know. But the power of recollection seems to strengthen with use, and the act of remembering apparently strengthens the memories themselves. It makes sense when you think about it. Synapses physically reinforced or replaced, that sort of thing. But then, if you can't face what you remember... Oh, Michelle... She took in a big, unsteady breath. They said... Marina said that Frank had murdered John... She said it to the others when she thought I couldn't hear, said it as if it was something they all knew. She clutched him by the shoulder, squeezed as if she could rip the truth out of him with her claws. Tell me the truth, Michelle. Is it true? Is that what you all think happened? Michelle shook his head. No one knows what happened. I was there. I was in Nicosia that night, and they weren't. I was with Frank when it happened. He had no idea, I swear. Michelle squinted, uncertain, and she said, Don't look like that. I'm not, Maya, I'm not. I don't mean anything by it. I have to tell you everything I've heard, and I'm trying to remember myself. There have been rumors, all kinds of rumors, about what happened that night. It's true, some say Frank was involved, or connected to the Saudis who killed John, that he met with the one who died later the next day, and so on. Maya began to weep harder. She bent over her clenched stomach and put her face on Michelle's shoulder, her ribs heaving. I can't stand it. If I don't know what happened, how can I remember? How can I even think of them? Michelle held her, soothed her with his embrace. He squeezed the muscles of her back over and over. Ah, Maya. After a long time, she sat up, went to the sink and washed her face in cold water, avoiding the mirror's gaze. She returned to the bed and sat, utterly despondent, a seeping blackness in every muscle. Michelle took her hand again. I wonder if it might not help to know. Or at least to know as much as you can. To investigate, you know, to read about John and Frank. There are books now, of course, and to ask the other people who were in Nicosia, particularly the Arabs who saw Selim el Hayl before he died, that kind of thing. It would give you a kind of control, you see. It wouldn't be remembering exactly, but it wouldn't be forgetting either. Those aren't the only two alternatives, strange as it may seem. We have to assume our past, you see. We have to make it a part of what we are now by an act of the imagination. It's a creative thing, an active thing. It's not a simple process. But I know you, and you are always better when you are active, when you have a little control. I don't know if I can, she said. I can't stand not to know, but I'm afraid to know. I don't want to know, especially if it's true. See how you feel about it, Michelle suggested. Try it and see. Given that both alternatives are painful, it might be you prefer action to the alternative. Well, she sniffed, took a single glance across the room. From the room on the other side of the mirror, an axe murderer stared out at her. My God, I'm so ugly, she said, revulsion making her nauseated to the verge of vomiting.
This ends side one of cassette 14. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.